Welcome to another episode of the Bowden Education Podcast with me, Catherine Carden, as your host, where we take the time to talk to people who are making a positive and transformational impact in education. Our summer series showcases educational professionals who are truly committed to their work and whose work is vital for those working in education. Today, I'm delighted to be chatting to Andrew Cowley about predominantly well-being. Andrew has a background in primary education and was a deputy head, as well as holding an MA in language, literature and learning. Andrew's now a well-being speaker, writer and trainer, and focuses his work on developing well-being strategies and embedding cultures of well-being for staff and children, working with heads, senior leadership teams, teachers and trainees. Andrew also acts as a coach for the designated mental health leads and the School Mental Health Award with Leeds Beckett University. Andrew has a best-selling book, The Wellbeing Toolkit, which you may well be familiar with, and most recently, The Wellbeing Curriculum. And I can't wait to find out more. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Catherine, and delighted to be chatting to you today.
I'm really looking forward to our chat. So before we really start to dig into the idea of well-being, could you talk to us a little bit and or maybe summarise your career to date?
Yeah, pleased to. I didn't go straight into teaching after graduating at the age of 21. For various reasons. I thought I was going to, but a couple of things fell through. I ended up working in commerce. I worked in the insurance industry, and that caused me to move south, because I'm originally from the north of England. And I spent some time working in the City of London and in Docklands before it was quite as glassy and steely as it is now. So I had 6 years working there, and then I decided I would make the break to the career I originally thought I would have. So I had 6 years behind me, and that's when I trained as a primary teacher nearly 30 years ago, and that took me through the rest of that time. I had the opportunity, once I'd trained, I did PGC at the Institute of Education, and I worked my entire career in South East London, taught every year group, but predominantly years 5 and 6 for most of my career, those older children. And so that's given me a real strong overview of learning right through the schools, and particularly as deputy head, when I was at a small school where I knew everyone, and that gave me a real strong link with the entire community. So that's one thing that's brought me a great deal of professional pleasure. What I do now, as you say, since I made the decision to step out of frontline education, is supporting the Carnegie Centre of Excellence on the designated mental health lead and mental health award. In addition to some speaking and supporting opportunities elsewhere. So that's pretty much in a couple of minutes. My life over the last 30 plus years.
So what then drives and inspires you to work and remain working in education?
Well, very simply, what I joined the education community to make a difference to the lives of young people, and I feel it's still possible for me to be doing that, even though I'm not in schools at the current time. But it's given me a chance to reflect and to continue to organize resources, organize thinking, continue writing and speaking in ways that will help support colleagues to do the absolute very best for our young people, because I do have a vested interest in making sure the young people are doing that absolutely very best, because many people will know that I have a little lady granddaughter who's now 9 months old. So yes, I'm very very interested in making sure that her future is secure in school.
And I often get asked as well, because I also stepped away from the classroom and then into higher education and so on. And people say, ask me about the impact, therefore, that I do have, because I share the same view as you, that I want to have an impact on the lives of children and young people. Actually, if you reflect on it, your impact is potentially wider, because your books are reaching many people who then work with many classes. The people you talk to and work and mentor are working with many classes and therefore many children. Whereas if you're a class teacher,
yeah,
have your class to impact. So it's potentially a great impact, but perhaps narrower. So I'm sure there is a huge reach for your impact these days, definitely. So your work now focuses around wellbeing in education. And I mentioned your two books earlier, The Wellbeing Toolkit and The Wellbeing Curriculum, both focus on this. The Wellbeing Toolkit looks at how schools can support the wellbeing of teachers. And that's a topic that is very front and center in teacher and education media. And we hear about how teachers are feeling challenged around their well-being. But what do you think are the underlying causes of well-being issues and challenges that are being faced by teachers?
Yeah, if I go back to my starting point in writing about well-being, it came from the blog I wrote for the group of four of us set up an account called Healthy Toolkit back in 2016, so 6 years ago now, and I started writing the blog for it, and we were looking initially at thinking about what well-being was offering, and it was very fluffy things. Let's have some meditation, let's make sure we drink plenty of water, let's have some mindfulness. I mean, they're all important things, don't get me wrong, and there are many people get a great deal from mindfulness, but it's just something that's nice to do. But it's not for everyone. If you've ever been to a session where somebody's demonstrated some mindfulness, practitioners will say, if you're not comfortable with doing this or feel a little shy in doing it, just step aside and just observe what everyone else does. Which is absolutely fine. And then people who have taken part in it and do find it very beneficial, but it's something for your own choice. If you're doing it with the children in class, it's something you might teach them as a technique that is that they can use to help themselves if they're feeling a little less calm or a little anxious about something. But again, with the children, you would also say to them that you, if you don't feel comfortable, don't do it. It's a choice. But that sort of made us as a group realise that there was much more to well-being than that. There were fundamental things which were impacting upon how teachers felt in the course of their jobs. And it's basically came down to things like workload. That's important to say there is a massive difference with work and workload, because we can't get away from the work. Teaching is hard work, planning lessons, resourcing lessons, assessing them, writing reports, doing parenting. You can't get away from that. There's no removal of that, but the workload is different, and that's how excessive that can be. We need to think about cognitive overload with our teachers, just as we do with our children as well. If they're overloaded, there's an information overload in a lesson, the children just don't learn enough. So if there's a cognitive overload with our teachers, if they're simply overloaded, they're not going to cope with events. They're going to be under stress, and it's going to impact upon how they feel. So workload was one particular thing, and it's often driven by really high stakes accountability that is probably at the root of much of the impact upon well-being of teachers and other staff in school, because we mustn't just say it's for teachers. These are our TAs, our office staff, our senior leaders as well, because well-being is very much for everyone. So that accountability is at the root of it, but it's then transpires in different ways. So we often hear the term toxicity applied in schools. And often in some social media channels, it talks about toxic social, toxic senior leadership. And while there certainly are some elements of toxicity in senior leadership, toxicity can come from anywhere within the workplace. Workplace bullying can come from any part of the school. And when I was actually investigating this, I found all sorts of tales from different parts of schools, which I suspected that people were very open in saying where they felt the issues were. And even comes out in things like something so minor as you think as the staff social at the end of term, but that became for many people an area of such great stress. They didn't want to attend or felt uncomfortable, and then in some cases they actually decided to leave the school because of how social occasions went. They're fine with the children while we're in school, but it was just that other side of it just made it quite unpleasant. So there are broader things about well-being. I begin by talking about what well-being isn't. It isn't mindfulness, meditation, and massage, is the nice bit of alliteration that I use. It's not a tick box exercise. It's not about being nice. Some people think it's about nice. It's not about offering cakes in the staff room. It's very much something that needs to be strategic and proactive.
Yeah, and funnily enough, I've got a chapter with a mutual friend of ours, Adrian Bethune, coming out in primary teaching today, second edition, coming out soon, little plug. But we've done a wellbeing chapter and we've called it It's More Than Donuts in the Staff Room.
Yeah.
And it absolutely is. Mm-hmm. And talk to me about the strategic. That's interesting. I'm interested in that it's strategic.
It's strategic. Let's put our governor hat on for a minute, because I'm just taking on a role as governor in a local school. Get away from the operational side. The strategy needs to be, quite simply, we need happy teachers for happy learners, and we need to make sure that our teachers stay in our school, or if they do move on, they're moving on for professional development. They're not moving on because they feel bullied out. And I think increasingly with especially what's the research at the Education Support Partnership is finding about the high levels of stress within schools. 84% of leaders reporting being highly stressed, 77% of teachers and other school staff, 54% seriously considering leaving the profession. It doesn't mean they're all going to leave, but some of them will. That's where strategy comes in. So the strategy needs to be thinking about how are we going to keep our teachers in the schools? How are we going to keep them in the profession? And that strategy needs to think about how they're supported, how their workload is addressed, how we listen to them and take their concerns seriously. One response I can get from senior leaders is we don't want to do surveys because we're afraid of what we might hear. Or some say it's just an excuse for a moan from some members of staff. Well, in many cases it will be a chance to have a moan, but I always say you've got to be able to suck it up and think about taking that on the chin because there will be some who take it as an opportunity just to sort of raise some petty issues, but I do feel that more serious issues will be raised through that. And if we think more broadly about culture in a workplace, and here we need to think about going beyond school, because teachers aren't the only ones who have issues around their well-being. Every other workplace does. NHS staff, very opposite in the last couple of years. Civil servants, also very opposite in the last couple of years. Members of the armed services, police, fire service, people in private industry all have their issues around it. So we need to look at things like cultures. And I draw a lot of influence actually from the world of sporting cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing some reading recently. I've read the book by James Kirk, Legacy. And that's about the success of the New Zealand All Blacks.
Right.
And it points out that New Zealand is a small country, about 5 million people, yet it consistently produces the best, most competitive and most respected rugby team in the world. England, for example, has more rugby union players than any other country combined. So why isn't England the best side in the world? Because the culture's not there in the same way. And one of the cool things, if you do read that book, in the very first chapter, it talks about sweeping the sheds. And the sheds is the New Zealand term for the changing rooms. And it's the leaders who sweep the sheds. So once the training session is finished, the leaders get out the brooms and they brush up all the mud from the boots, the bits of liniment that have fallen off injuries, and they are the ones that tidy up. They don't leave that to a caretaker or a junior member of the team. They do it. And that ties in quite nicely with, if anyone's ever read any Simon Sinek work,
mm-hmm.
Why? Start with your why.
We must have a weird beam going on, because I was just going to say this morning I was listening to a Simon Sinek podcast and he was talking about team, but he was talking, and I'm just looking it up because he was talking to, and he talks a lot to military people, and I'm trying to find out now who I was talking to. It could be Brigadier General Michael Johnny Bravo Drowley on his podcast, and he was talking about team and how it's different in the military and it's more like a family. So that was an interesting, but yeah, Simon Sinek does some fantastic thoughts.
Yeah, and even if you just sent messages from his titles, it brought Leaders Eat Last.
Yeah.
Is another one I must reread read those as well, because that what he does there is, I think it's important that the school leaders think beyond the bubble of school and actually think about how you're dealing with people. One of the core quotes from the Wellbeing Toolkit is that half of what we do in school is about culture and relationships, the other half is about relationships and culture. And basically, you're talking about culture and relationships, you're talking about systems, and you're talking about people, which I think is the same of any workplace.
Yeah, and I think culture is so important and it fascinates me. And you can sense culture as soon as you step into a school. And it's something that if the culture isn't positive and conducive to positive well-being, it's something sometimes that's so hard to shift.
Mm.
Unless you want to buy in. You need everyone to buy into the culture.
Yeah, cultures take time. And cultures aren't built. If you build something, you take a school building. You know, you start the foundations, you stick the walls up and you put the roof on the top. That's a linear system. That's the only way to do it. And that's going to be pretty much unchanging unless you have an extension added on. But growing takes time. And I often make a horticultural comparison when I speak out of this. Let's think about growing grain runner beans. you know, it takes time. If you just scatter them at random and some land on the paper, they're not going to grow. If you plant but don't, you put them in a patch where you some weeds grow, the weeds will end up choking them. If you plant with love and with care, they will germinate, but you need to make sure they're nourished, they're watered, they grow. And then you need to put the support in with those beans, because they're not going to grow along the ground, they need to grow up. So they get the air, they get the sunlight, they get water. And it's the same way building a culture in a school. It takes the time, you've got to nurture it. And of course, it's cyclical. Growing beans is cyclical. Growing a culture is cyclical. Year on year, you're going to get changes in the school. You may be fortunate enough to retain your staff, same staff for the next year, but the children are going to change. Mm. The parents are going to change. And you respond to those changes to make that successful. In the same way, going back to our beans, you look after those, they grow, you pick, you get your harvest. But that's not the end of it. You go back and plan for it for next year to make sure that worked. And you learn from your mistakes. I didn't plant quite deep enough. I didn't water them quite enough. I didn't feed them often enough. I fed them the wrong thing. You learn from that for the next year and improve. And that's the same. That's the way a culture in a workplace will grow at work. It's not an instant thing. The only instant culture you can create is a culture of fear by telling people what to do. But yeah. A culture of true development does take time. It takes patience.
Yeah, and I think for me, well-being is quite often badged as something that's easy to achieve because you just do X, Y, and Z. And like going back to our kind of, you know, I'll put some donuts or cakes in the staff room on a Friday or whatever. But because that's just superficial, it's actually not so easy to achieve well-being. And I think maybe people don't invest enough, and we need to start with things like building trust, creating a psychological safety. That takes time, because a leader can demonstrate that's what they're going to do. So they might make a change or interact with staff in a way. That's not overnight going to change trust or create psychological safety. It needs to be repeated, repeated, repeated as the trust builds. And maybe that's part of it. It's not a quick fix. And yet we're used to quick fixing in schools.
Yeah, exactly. And quick fixes don't work. Because if you're trying to change things, I mean, if you're looking at trying to change a habit, it takes anywhere between 30 and 60 days to create something as a habit. And that's just in our own lives. So, for example, if you were looking to improve your physical fitness, I'm going to go on a fitness regime, and very often we hear about this in January, and gym memberships are taken up in January. But by the end of January, that's gone. It takes time. You've got to get into that habit of that and to maintain it. And the same way in a workplace as well. If we just went back to the cake scenario for a minute, I'm often asked about this, and I say we need to dig deeper. Because does it include everyone? Say we do cakes on a Friday at staff room, let's say. What about that person who's on break duty? Do they get their cake? Do they get their well-being? What about when they turn up at lunchtime? Oh, I'll get my cake now. They've all gone. Or they've gone stale. They're not getting their well-being. What about that person who's got gluten intolerance? What about the people who maybe, if you've got members of staff there who are fasting for religious beliefs, they're missing out on that particular treat. You know, it's thinking a bit further. Cakes are a nice thing to do. Let's not be wrong about that. I think everyone appreciates a cake and a nice cup of tea, but you need a bit more thought around it. But it's not well-being. Well-being is deeper.
So do you think, though, that the issues that we're facing, are they? Because this has been a real stubborn problem. We've been talking about teacher wellbeing, teacher attrition for a long time now. This isn't a new news, and the problem isn't going away. And you were telling me just before we started recording about the number of early career teachers that are leaving the profession. And do you think it's possible to turn this situation around? And where would you start?
That's a real challenge of our times, turning that around. The figures were, and I saw last week, suggesting that 1 in 8 early career teachers are leaving in their first year. And of course, early career teachers now have a 2-year cycle to get through that time rather than the older NQT year. That's very much changed. 1 in 8 is a massive investment that's been wasted, and they're going in the first year. What are the reasons they're going? We need to look at that. We need to look at exit surveys if they go ahead. I don't always think they go ahead, and I don't know if they're even seriously looked at. Again, you know, the cynical side of some people might say, well, they're leaving, they might just give it as an excuse to have a go at the leadership of the school, which is possibly true. But again, that needs to be sucked up, it needs to be listened to. If 1 in 8 of our teachers are early career teachers are going in their first year, we need to listen to the reasons why they are. How do we address it beyond listening? I certainly think initial teacher education needs to include an element about well-being, and it needs to go beyond self-care, because we can mention self-care, great, but self-care looks different for everyone, and many people will have developed some of their own self-care strategies, the way they look after themselves, what they do for their own physical health, their own mental health. They may have some strategies before they enter the workplace. They're not always going to solve your problems of the stresses you face in the workplace. I think we need to be looking about teaching emotional intelligence and making people aware of emotional intelligence and the impact of their words, their deeds, and even their thoughts upon other people is really important to understand. And that applies to anyone in the school. And I include thoughts in that, because your thoughts determine your values and your attitudes, and your attitudes determine your behaviours. Now, if your thoughts are not the most positive in a workplace, your behaviours are not going to be the most positive, and that's the sort of thing that creates stresses and tensions and toxicity that can impact upon people's decision to stay teaching.
I also think, and this is maybe a little bit contentious, but I've been doing some work with an FE group, and we've been looking at well-being of staff within there, but this may sound tricky, but I actually think we need to bring to the attention of staff and trainee teachers and alike their responsibility with regard to well-being. I think well-being is kind of othered into becoming, oh, it's this job to make me well, and actually it's a contributed effort. School needs to put in the frameworks, but you are responsible to making sure you're showing up to work well.
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone is a contributor. One thing I actually really talk about quite a lot in my work is everyone is a well-being leader. It's not a top-down model. If you went to school and the head teacher says staff well-being here is great, yeah, perhaps it might be, but how do you know? Is it just them saying it? It can't always necessarily be a bottom-up model, because again, that's simply responding in a reactive manner. But if we use the term sideways in, everyone has got that responsibility. Everyone is responsible for everyone else. And if you took the model of a classroom, 30 primary children, obviously under the care of the teacher and teaching assistant, but they've all got responsibilities to each other. And I think it's a really impactful thing to get them to think about their relationships with each other and who is friends with who and who supports each other. Recently, I've been looking at the work of use of sociograms, which I think is actually really effective within a classroom for looking at the relationships within a class. Who are the more dominant people? Who gets interaction both ways? Who's got arrows going to almost everyone, and who's got arrows going to no one? And if you transferred that way of thinking also to your staff and had a look at who is only ever gives out but gets nothing back, I think you'll find that's quite a lot. And very often that's senior leaders will give out a lot and get nothing back in the way of support. You might have some very genuine people who give out a lot and get stuff back because of their particular role, of course, their personality, etc. And then you will also get those who take but give nothing, or what they do give is negative. And that's a really important exercise to have. And it's not an excuse to, you know, to move yourself around, but it gives you action points to with these people and having some of the more challenging conversations. I noticed you ask this, but you give back comparatively little. I mean, you need to use your language appropriately, but that will help you get that buy-in in that culture by having an understanding of everyone and their relationships within the workplace.
And I do think schools have a responsibility to set up those frameworks in whatever way. So the frameworks of how they're talking to their staff, they're having the difficult conversations, because that can lead to a negativity if they're just avoided. But that takes some bravery for leaders. So that's something they need to think about right from saying book scrutinies. No, we don't need to do those so much. No, we're not going to observe so much, and releasing the stress wherever that stress factor is. But at the same time, having very high expectations of their staff to look after themselves, to do the right thing. Schools cannot control whether a staff member is planning at 2 a.m. in the morning. They can't. That's up to the staff to set those boundaries. So it is a two-way. It's maybe we should talk about how they're well-being.
Yeah, there is that side. And I think something else also worth considering is some people aren't very good at their own personal organisation, which is why I've seen people who got through a class worth of books in an hour and then gone home. But I've seen others who got in that hour, they might get through three or four. It's just because they were working. It's ways of working you need to perhaps do some support on. How can I help you work quicker? Are they doing too much? Are they procrastinating? I think it's important to think about that particular side of people, so they're taking that responsibility, but also not doing things that impact upon their time. And time is the most valuable resource that our teachers have. So very often they aren't planning at 2 o'clock in the morning. Are we taking too much of their time in school with other things? Have they got so many responsibilities that they think their time management is so challenged they have to be doing that? I think it's important to know if anyone's doing that. Because obviously that is going to impact upon their health if they are 2 a.m. Most people have at 2 a.m. are tucked up in bed and halfway through their night's sleep. But I do know people are, because they share that. They share that on social media.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a real, as a colleague of mine recently said about sustainability, it's a wicked problem. And I think well-being remains a wicked problem, a really difficult thing to solve. But there are steps that you can do it. In your most recent book, you look at, though, developing a curriculum of well-being for pupils. So why is that so important?
Again, if I go back to what I said earlier, very simply, happy teachers make for happy children, which make for happy learners. And I talk about, again, getting away from that fluffy, simplistic view about well-being, but actually think about it in its absolutely broadest sense. So it's also thinking about the values and character development of our young people, so that they become good citizens and impact positively upon everyone else. Also thinking about the mental health of those young people, and being self-aware about their own stresses and anxieties and how they deal with those. But as well as that, is actually think as a school to develop a curriculum. And I'm thinking beyond pure lessons. Curriculum time is every minute in school, from the minute they walk the gate to the minute they walk home, and in many ways after school as well, because they've got increasingly one of the impacts of the pandemic is working online. I know schools are still set their work on Google Classroom, for example. If we think broadly about the whole time that they're in school, so the time walking through the corridors, the time in assemblies, the time in the hall, the time on the playground, they are learning opportunities. They are opportunities to show their character, show their values, show their trust, show their kindness, which are all part of a really broad definition of being well, being physically well, being mentally well, being socially and economically well.
Yeah, but in our education system, and I read somewhere, and I think it was about students, glanced at it on social media, and it said there's been an increase of something like 400% in mental health issues amongst students. And we think of children and we hear about the rise in mental health and well-being issues with children. And we want to combat that. And that's why people are in as workers, teachers and TAs, because they want to support the holistic and rounded development of children. Yet at the same time, we're working in a system that completely challenges that, because what all we do is spend our time weighing the pig and not feeding the pig, as I say. We're testing children. Once they get into year 9 and certainly in year 10, then in secondary school, there aren't many sort of weeks they don't have a test to see where they're at and where they might be. And that, I know, comes down from pressure. And then we've got endpoint exams now. So whilst we're trying to develop their well-being, at the same time we are working in a system, it's difficult. I'm not saying we can't do it, is what it is, but there is a tension there, isn't there?
There very definitely is. And I think we need to get the balance absolutely right, because if you've got, and this is not a new thing at all, I've seen it over the course of my time at school. I went to a grammar school in North England. I was in the penultimate year of it, so there were no newer pupils apart from the year after me. But that was very much academically driven. Oxbridge was an expectation of them. But I look at my contemporaries now, look at what they've gone on to, and thinking, how many of you have actually lived the values in your life that you would have expected, or how many of you have been driven by examination success, and that's gone on to your attitude, your children as well. And what's been the impact of that? I mean, I had one very close friend who was absolutely pushed, was an A grade student, everything. But ended up not completing the degree and didn't get into the profession that might have been expected of him of the system. And that just shows to me that sort of broader side was not being addressed for this particular person, but I think many others who didn't have that, and just sort of academic success was everything. Yeah, the people I remained friends with still were those that had that broader vision of their impact upon broader society. So, you know, people I'm still in contact with from my my primary school, grammar school days, were those who'd gone into things like teaching, the health service, and professions where you think there is a sense of a public service, not one of self.
Mm. And that's something interesting with Simon Sinek talks a lot about, isn't it, service? But I think it's really hard because we're in this system where grades matter. And I say that in inverted commas, because they matter, because we're driven by league tables, because we're driven by, you know, data, and that translates into how good a school you are.
Yeah.
And I think parents also struggle not to jump on the bandwagon as well. And it's really hard as a parent to step back and not be sucked in by push as well.
I still think we can produce children with excellent grades and have children who are good citizens at the same time, and that comes out of that question of balance, and that comes out of that question of strategy, because I think the two need to come together. We want good citizens, but we want good well-qualified citizens. It's getting that balance right. And if we are focusing on academic above pastoral, then what sort of young people are we producing?
We could talk for hours, I'm sure, about the assessment system and the examination, and what is that showing us? Does it really show us, if you like, the raw intelligence of a child, but someone who could excel if they presented their knowledge in a different way? So we're very funneled at the moment in what we're expecting and what we're then producing, or what children look like on paper is probably far removed from what they are as people.
They are, yeah, and that's important to know. If we think about the job application process, whether you fill in it, you're a CV or fill out an application form, that only shows a certain side of somebody. And we all know that the job application process is you look at the person spec and you talk about the things that you do that fit the person spec. But do our person specs include the ability to be emotionally intelligent, the ability to respond appropriately under pressure to a challenging situation regarding a colleague's anxiety or stress, for example? Or do we go down the a very typical head teacher's in-tray activity? So that's about prioritising. And it's all about, you've got an angry letter from a parent as one option, or you've got assembly in 5 minutes and the caretaker's gone off sick and the radiator's blown up. Which one do you do? Yeah, obviously they're all important things to do, but when do we look at emotional intelligence? Where's the one that says you've got a member of staff who comes in crying?
Yeah.
2 minutes to 2 minutes before the bell, because they're under such stress, they don't have the chance to speak to you, that they a concerned colleague has brought them to you. Where's the place for that in intro activities? And I think emotional intelligence would probably say that's your priority, that member of staff right then.
Yeah, and also the notion on an in-tray activity about if you're a great leader, you'll have a really good team. So actually half of these problems aren't your problem because you'll have someone to step up if you're a great leader. We've talked a little bit about pupil well-being. We've talked a lot about teacher well-being. What comes first in a school, teacher well-being or pupil well-being?
Yeah, well, that's the real chicken and egg question, isn't it? My sit on the fence answer is they're both the same. To go a bit deeper than that is you can't have one without the other. But I think you've got to get it right with the teachers and the rest of your staff first. Because if they're not happy, your pupils won't be happy. Just in very simple terms. Being in the primary school, you might have been that children are cute and they can pick up on emotions. They can pick up on whether the teacher is feeling unhappy or stressed because they go home and they tell their parents.
Yeah.
And Mrs. So-and-so looked at a very happy day. Mr. What's his name was quite cross. It's not like it. And they know that, and they pick up on that, and they'll respond to that, and they will know, and that will impact the atmosphere in the classroom. If that unhappiness is because something's happened outside, when we've a number of times I've had colleagues who've been through a relationship breakup, clearly that impacts and makes them feel unhappy. We need to be as leaders empathetic and supportive in school, and recognising that we provide a supportive environment around them as much as we can, as much as they want to be supported in school. But if that unhappiness is down to degrees of stress caused by school, such as sudden book scrutiny, right? I want all books from this class in the next half hour. That naturally triggers anxiety because your first thought is, I didn't mark that piece of work from last week. Didn't pick up on that. And if you're in an atmosphere where you fear that mistakes are picked up on and criticised, but good practice isn't recognised and rewarded, then you're in a you create a cycle of challenge in the way people think. So we need to look at that, getting that right with our teachers. Teachers know that something is going to happen. They know there's going to be a certain amount of monitoring and of what they're doing. But that monitoring needs to be supportive.
Yeah.
Because a good teacher doesn't suddenly become a poor teacher overnight.
No.
There are teachers who, and there are reasons why, yeah, bits of marking don't get done, and sometimes some deadlines are missed. Yeah. But if you organise your school appropriately, so everyone knows what the deadlines are, and if they are struggling with them, they need to have the ability to say, the confidence to say, I'm struggling with this deadline, can I have some more time? Can I have some support? And again, as you might grant that. But you also need to think about why is this, how can we be helping this person so this doesn't become a problem the next time around? That's the kind of thing to
think
about. So I think schools need to prioritise teacher well-being, but if they get that teacher well-being right, that's going to make it so much easier to get that pupil well-being right.
Absolutely. And to finish, back to you, really, and your career. What is there something you've been most proud of? It's a difficult question after a long career to say most proud of, but is there something that you are really proud of so far in your career?
Lots and lots of things. I'm very proud of every pupil who's left my charge with a measure of success. But I tell you, one of the things that I really appreciated is when you meet a pupil a number of years later. I found they work in the same area of London. You bump into people, children, where your children now adults in workplaces, in shops, in hospitals. You bump into them and they say, it's like, oh, I really remember that lesson you taught us on. One of their favourite books actually was the book Holes, and I mean, this child, he was about 18. I said, I really remember you teaching us the book Holes, and you did all the accents and you brought so much out of it. And we sat there in year six on the last day of term when we're all leaving. We sat under the tree while you finished the book for us. I think that there's things like that. It's a moment, it's not a learning moment. I think that's, you think year six on their last afternoon, they want to be just charging around the field, throwing water bombs at each other. But they didn't. They wanted to sit and hear the end of the book in their last few minutes in primary school. They were really appreciative of that. And it's things like that, that when you reflect, they're the important things, but they're about the bigger picture.
And then is there something that you still aspire to achieve that's niggling away and you think, I'd love to achieve that?
Well, I've been having this conversation with my wife. She said, we've written two books. You now need to write a book, a prize winner for us.
A big seller.
Yeah.
Okay, another book. Well, it's been so fascinating talking to you. We could talk for hours about well-being, and I always go away from these conversations sort of fired up and inspired, and want to carry on doing my own work. So thank you. And of course, you can follow Andrew on Twitter at Andrew_Cowley23. And you can access his books, and they're on the Bowden Education website publications page. You can click on them and it will take you through to Amazon, or you can get them from any of your other preferred booksellers. And they're well worth a read. So thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Catherine. And you have a good day. And all the listeners, you enjoy the rest of your day as well.